I'd like to welcome everyone to the Commission's hearing on proposed rules regarding independent expenditures by corporations and unions. We will discuss the notice of proposed rulemaking on independent expenditures by corporations and unions, which was published in the Federal Register on December 27, 2011. The NPRM explained and sought comment on proposed rules in response to the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States in Citizens United v. FEC, and also in response to a petition for rulemaking filed by the James Madison Center for Free Speech. I'd like to thank all of the people who took the time and effort to comment on the proposed rules, and in particular to those who appear as witnesses at this hearing today to give us the benefit of their practical experience and expertise on issues raised by the proposed rules. We will have a total of five witnesses who have been divided into two panels. We will hear from both panels today. The first panel will last for 1 hour and 5 minutes, and the second for 1 hour and 15 minutes. The first will start in a few minutes and end at 11:15, followed by a short break. The second panel is at 11:30 and will conclude at 12:45 this afternoon. Each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We have a light system that will hopefully work today. The yellow light's supposed to go on when you have 30 seconds left.
Would the commission be offering a permission for something that is not prohibited? And of course, that creates confusion among those who would like to comply with your regulations, because the presumption could only be, if you're giving permission, that other things which you are not permitting are otherwise restricted or banned. And of course, that's not true anymore. Now, it is true that there are still some regulatory requirements for independent expenditures, electionary communications, and membership communications. And it is also true that the prohibition on corporations and labor unions making contributions still survives. And of course, those still need to be implemented in your regulations. But I think you should do so very expressly. In other words, that your regulation structure should be explain what is prohibited or regulated. In other words, that you have to file reports for certain activities. You have to, you can't do coordinated expenditures or making in-kind contributions to a candidate. And to the extent that you artificially create distinctions between corporations and labor unions, you should avoid doing that. In other words, it's not necessary to tell a corporation, it's not necessary to tell a corporation that they have to do an independent expenditure report when of course they are a person, and if they make an independent expenditure, they're required to do it. You also don't have to tell them that coordinated expenditures are treated as contributions, because your other regulations do that. And if a corporation would coordinate its expenditures, then it would be making a prohibited contribution, whereas to others, they would be simply limited by contribution limits. So to the extent that the any distinctions are not pertinent, they should not be used. They should not be used. Now, so that then takes you to what are the pertinent distinctions. There are three pertinent distinctions that should be adhered to. One is the distinction between expenditure and contribution, because the prohibition continues from 441B on contributions by corporations and labor unions. Two, the distinction between prohibitions and disclosures should continue to be adhered to. There are no prohibitions, but there are reports or disclosures, and it should be made clear when those are required. And third, there is still a pertinent distinction between restricted class and a general public, but only to reporting of membership communications. And so when applicable, that distinction should be adhered to. But there is now no distinction between individuals and corporations, except for reporting membership communications. There's no distinction between a corporation and a qualified not-for-profit corporation. And there is certainly no distinction between, quote, pure speech and non-communicative speech, because Citizens United struck down on its face the prohibition on expenditures of any kind in connection with an election. So that distinction is simply not pertinent, even if it ever existed, which I don't think so. So I think a major rethinking of your regulations are required in order to provide the advice that Citizens United really insists that you do, that is, that lay people can examine these regulations, understand what they can do and not do, and rather than have to employ a lawyer, an accountant, and otherwise be discouraged.
Thank you, Mr. Bob. Mr. Trister?
Thank you. I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance for Justice, which has appeared many times before the commission as part of its efforts to increase and support advocacy by nonprofit organizations, particularly in today's case, 501c4 organizations. And our comments focused on specific aspects of the proposals that we think may have a deterrent effect on that kind of advocacy, and we've tried to point out those specific instances where we think corrections are possible. I'd like to just touch on several of those, and if you have questions about the ones I don't talk about, we'd be happy to answer those. The first is a provision which seems to have managed to get both the AFL, the Chamber of Commerce, and the nonprofit organizations all on the same page, which is the suggestion that the current regulation for MCFLs would remain in effect for all corporations and unions. And some of that is rather benign because it simply reports or repeats what's already in the regulations elsewhere and makes references to other parts of the regulations. But the one aspect of it that's not benign is the suggestion that organizations would have to include in their solicitations a statement that the funds, the donations that they're receiving would be may be used for political activity. And our objections to that provision are first and foremost that there's no statutory authority for it, period. Basic rule for disclaimers, which is in 441D, refers to contributions. And people who contribute to 501c4 organizations are not making contributions within the meaning of the statute. I think there's really, even if one wants to find authority within 441D for such a disclaimer type of requirement, it also doesn't go as far as this provision would. It requires, as you know, PACs to state that when they solicit contributions, for example, it's not authorized. The communication by a PAC, in some cases for express advocacy, are not authorized by any candidate or political party. It also you have to state who's paid for the ad. But there's nothing that says that you have to state that the use of the funds that you're trying to collect from donors may be used for political purposes. That requirement came out of the MCFL decision and was put into the regulations, I think, in response to what the Supreme Court said. But MCFLs are, no longer a relevant entity, so to speak. And secondly, the purpose of that the Supreme Court was using, or what motivated the Supreme Court, was to distinguish for-profit corporations from certain ideological corporations. And in that context, the requirement of giving notice may have made some sense. It does not make sense after Citizens United, which eliminates that distinction entirely. I think that there's really no basis for, in the statute or anywhere else, really, for commission adopting from nowhere a requirement of that kind, and we strongly oppose it. A second point that we made and appears in several of your regulations is the notion of coordination and the failure in the proposals to limit the concept of coordination to coordinated communications that appear in the regulations at 109.21. We're very concerned. This is particularly the case in 114.4 C2, where the suggestion is made that there's new language which would be inserted to say that the following types of activities, like voter guides and voting records and endorsements, are all subject to a coordination test. But it does not refer back to 4109.21. And the suggestion then is that we have some new kind of coordination test that's not defined, that's separate from 109.21. And I think that is a serious problem if that's what is intended by that language. The regulations in 109.21, as the Commission knows, were the subject of, I think, about three different rulemakings over the last few years that went to the Court of Appeals on two occasions, and we finally have a regulation that we think we have some we can rely on and try to interpret. And the idea that somehow another there's some other definition of coordination other than the one that's in the regulations that would apply to certain kinds of communications is a very serious problem. Problem for the regulated community as a whole, there are a number of different places which we point out in our comments where that problem emerges. A related point that I think needs attention, and I hope it's just an oversight, is in 114.4 C6 of the proposed regulations, which is the section that deals with endorsements to public communications. There's a reference to restricted class. And that's a mistake as a drafting matter, because 114.4 deals with communications to the general public. It's 114.3 that deals with communications to the restricted class. But it's more than a drafting problem. It's a substantive problem because of the coordination language which precedes it. If, in fact, the suggestion is being made that endorsements made to the restricted class cannot be coordinated, then that's counter to everything we've known for many, many years, which is that communications to the restricted class may be coordinated. And so it's a substantive problem as well as, I think, a drafting problem. And we would urge that if 114.4 C6 remains in the regulations, and we don't see any reason for it to be there, frankly, but if the Commission decides to leave in 114.4 C2 through 6, then that absolutely has to be cleared up, because it's a complete change of policy from what has been the case over the years. The I only have a second, so let me go start on this whole concept of non-expressive expenditures, which comes up in a number of different places in the NPRM. And I think that Jim has addressed that in part. And the question is raised, does Citizens United leave room, if you will, for prohibitions on non-expressive communications if they're not coordinated? And I think that one can read Citizens United, since it was dealing with an expressive communication, and that's what much of its language addresses, as being limited to so-called independent expenditures. But what I can find in the case, I think if one looks at the decision and looks at the core concept that the court was addressing in Citizens United, which is the notion of independence, and the notion that if expenditures are independent, then they do not give rise to a risk of corruption or an appearance of corruption, then that is as true of non-expressive expenditures as it would be of expressive expenditures. And I don't find anywhere in the decision a line that can be drawn that would support that kind of distinction. I have more to say about this, but my time's up, so we'll address it in questions probably.
That's a perfect segue, because that's exactly what I was going to ask about, which is the overarching issue that comes up numerous times in the NPRM regarding the distinction between whether or not, you know, the communication has to be just an independent expenditure, or does Citizens United also speak to things that are so-called non-communicative. So I was going to ask both of you to elaborate on that point, because as you note, it is relevant for a couple of the different provisions in the NPRM. So, Mr. Trister, would you like to conclude your thoughts on that? Thank you.
Okay. Well, as I said, I don't think you can find, if you look at what the court was saying in Citizens United, then I think you can't make that distinction. And I don't see, in some ways, it makes no sense to say that a nonprofit organization can spend hundreds of thousands or indeed millions of dollars on expressive communications that are IEs, but it can't take people to the polls and spend much less money taking people to the polls because that's non-expressive. And it just makes no sense to distinguish between the two, and I don't find that distinction anywhere in the decision. One of the things I was thinking about in connection with this issue was to go back to Buckley and say, because after all, Buckley struck down the limits on individual expenditures, individual IEs, and it was never thought, and indeed when Congress implemented Buckley, it didn't make a distinction. It knocked out the entire limit on expenditures by individuals. It didn't say, well, from now on, individuals can spend unlimited amounts on IEs, but they can't do it on non-expressive communications. That's not how Congress interpreted the Buckley decision with respect to individuals and unincorporated associations. Another case I was interested in was MCFL. Supreme Court says in MCFL that certain types of corporations can do IEs. And I looked at your regulations, and lo and behold, it doesn't distinguish between IEs, communicative expenditures, and non-communicative expenditures. In fact, your regulations specifically say that MCFL corporations could do expenditures as long as they're not coordinated. It doesn't make the distinction, which is appearing really for the first time in this NPRM. And so I don't really find any basis for the distinction. Let me ask Jim to go on.
Thank you. I agree with Mike. The you know, as a matter of constitutional law, the First Amendment protects symbolic speech. So you start right off with basically a phony distinction as far as First Amendment law is concerned, as if there are different standards under the First Amendment for, quote, pure speech, where you're actually talking, as opposed to where you're not talking. You burn a flag. You've done a matter that is fully protected by the First Amendment. So it's not a really pertinent. It's not a distinction grounded in the First Amendment. Secondly, there is of course a communicative aspect to everything that we're talking about here. Get out the vote, voter registration, all involves communications, written or oral communications to people to get them to be. To show up in an election or whatever the case may be, and that is core political activity and core political speech to ask somebody to go vote. So it's again on a First Amendment basis. There's no distinction here, but you don't even have to be a constitutional lawyer and go parse the cases. All you have to look to is the holding of Citizens United. They didn't strike down the prohibition on corporate expenditures in connection with an election, quote, as applied, end of quote, to independent expenditures or electioneering communications. If they had, then there would still be something else out here that the corporate expenditure prohibition applied to other activities that, quote, influence an election. But they didn't do that. They struck it down on its face. So once you that's done, where is the statutory authority to prohibit voter guides or voter registration activity or get out the vote activity, this non-communicative activity? Where is that statute that says a corporation can't do that? So all you have to do is look at the holding and see what you have left as far as the statute is concerned, find your statutory authority, and there is no statutory authority that would apply to that situation.
Thank you very much. Madam Vice Chair, do you have any questions at this time?
Actually, Madam Chair, I really don't. I thank the witnesses for coming in and for their comments, which I think were clear, but given the constraints that were placed on the topics that we were allowed to seek public comment on, I really don't have anything to ask.
Okay.
I'll reserve my time in case something comes up and I suddenly have a question.
Oh, sure. No problem. Any other questions? Commissioner McGann?
Thank you. Mr. Trister, in your comments on page 10, I think I just want to clarify the record. I hate to put you on the spot, but the first partial paragraph, the last sentence says, "We therefore urge the commission to reject
that's
alternative."
A mistake.
Right. I want to just clarify that for the record because we have
that
to
is a record.
Right. Okay. So
it's nice to see who's reading carefully. And
not. Right. So it's we urge the commission to reject
We support the alternative A,
that's
not
right,
not
so,
B.
Okay. Thank you.
Correct.
The disclaimer on solicitations, which Mr. Trister talked about. Let me ask Mr. Bopp, because I think you've kind of touched on it, but it seems to me that goes beyond the act. And I just want to help make the record here that you read it the same way, that for the commission to go in and put some new disclaimer requirement on particularly 501C seems to not be in the statute. You agree with that?
I agree with Mike's comments on that. This provision was based solely on mass citizens, and mass citizens was created an exemption from the prohibition on independent expenditures by corporations, and it was to implement a provision of the in the rationale of that a decision which said that these types of organizations are engaged in political activity and that donors who contribute to them know that they are contributing to an organization that does political activity. And that was part of the distinction between them and for-profit corporations. I understood the commission to adopt this requirement in order to make sure that donors to these ideological not-for-profits would know for sure that their contribution might be used for their donation might be used for that purpose. But absent that, the pertinence of that decision, there's no other statutory authority for it.
I would, if I could add one thought.
Sure.
There is a provision in 441B which uses similar language, but it's limited to separate segregated funds. And so Congress has enacted similar provision, but it's quite clearly limited to separate segregated funds where they want to make sure, and this is a provision that came out of the Pipefitters decision in 1972, and where the Supreme Court was dealing with the concept of voluntary contributions to PACs and wanted to ensure that they would be voluntary to the PAC rather than to the union in that particular case. And so the court talked about the need to put the members of the union on notice how the money was going to be spent. And that was then incorporated by Congress specifically in this section of 441B. But that's not that has no relevance in this context because indeed many 501C organizations spend money for things that have nothing to do with political purposes. So that, A, it is not relevant, and B, its language very clearly is limited to separate segregated funds. So I don't see where one can find in the statute any authority for what that proposal would be.
And I'm assuming that since Congress put it in the statute as applied to one person, they could have tried to have it go beyond that, but they didn't, and that's
right.
That's part of your answer. That's significant, correct?
Well, I think it's significant. I mean, one can explain it because back when it was added to the statute, corporations and unions couldn't do a political activity of the kind that Citizens United now allows them to do. But what it also says is that if that problem is going to be cured, it's for Congress to do it. If Congress wants to deal with it. The other issue is that it's a much bigger issue. The question of what kind of notice should be given by corporations in particular to their shareholders and to other people about how they're spending their money is a major issue. It's before Congress in many different proposals, and it's not for there are proposals for corporations to give reports to their shareholders, for example. Well, this provision wouldn't even deal with that. It's a very narrow provision that really wouldn't have any impact on for-profit corporations. It would only have an impact on organizations that raise, quote, donations. So it's very, very narrow. It doesn't really address the issues, and those issues have to be resolved by Congress. It's for Congress to decide if corporations are going to give notice to shareholders or to donors or other kinds of people as a result of Citizens United. It's in the first instance for Congress to resolve that, and they haven't done it.
If I could shift gears for a minute. Another commenter has suggested that we keep a certain reg, the reg that was promulgated by the commission after WRTL that turned that opinion into a multi-factor balancing test and the CU court was none too pleased with. And I think the point the commenter is making is because the coordination rule talks about functional equivalent of express advocacy, that at least gives something on paper that they can look to. At least gives you a safe harbor and eliminates some things. So I think the point isn't to get us to vote once again for a multi-factor balancing test. I think it's to at least put a hash mark out there so that the commission can't get carried away with itself down the road. I'd like to get your thoughts on that, because I'm torn on this point, because the test itself is frankly a mess, and whether I think that or not doesn't matter. The Supreme Court has said it's a mess. But I do understand the concern of having a free-floating, undefined test, and maybe there is some merit to keeping it. Mr. Bopp, do you have any thoughts on what we should do?
Yeah. I guess the benefit of repealing it in context of what you were just saying is it is true that the Supreme Court rejected your regulation as being utterly unfaithful to Wisconsin Right to Life, and because you converted it from a simple test into a two-part 11-factor balancing test, which was not what they did in Wisconsin Right to Life, and frankly, I think it had an effect on the Supreme Court. I remember the famous statement that Chief Justice Roberts said, "You know, we're not going to leave protection of First Amendment rights to FEC bureaucrats." Well, I think you got that tongue lashing because of that regulation. I mean, it was defiance of the court, as far as I can see, and I think they reacted that way, and it led to them reconsidering Austin. If you'd have been faithful, they may not have done that. So, because it's not faithful, it should be repealed. Then at least you're not bound to an unfaithful, obviously unconstitutional, obviously one that's derived of any statutory authority. At least you can debate that question of what functional equivalent means and go back to the sources of that, rather than be bound by a regulation that is invalid, unfaithful, and the court's already said so.
Now, your client you represent here today, though, doesn't do, I don't think they do any IEs that may end up being accused of being coordinated down the road, right?
That's correct. Okay. We don't do any political intervention at all.
So, Mr. Trister, in your client, your umbrella of C4s, what are your thoughts on this issue?
Well, let me first say that we didn't comment on that question, so I can't really speak for the alliance on that question, but I'm on my own here. I think, as you pointed out, it's a very close question. Some more guidance might be helpful. On the other hand, the court, I won't use the colorful language that both you and Mr. Bopp use, but definitely the court was not happy with the regulations that were issued. And on balance, I think, as somebody who represents lots of organizations that may be, that are dealing with potential coordination issues, I think I come out in favor of not having the regulation. I think the regulation creates so many different difficult questions and sort of takes on a life of its own that is not necessary or needed within the context of a coordination case. And so I would go with the language that's in 109.21 and leave it at that. But as I said, I'm speaking for myself here as a practitioner rather than for any particular groups, because we didn't review that issue.
Okay. Final question. A few of the points you made, Mr. Trister, are well taken. It wasn't the intent to have the one point where we failed to the proposal fails to limit its application to certain communications, and then there's 114.C6 issue. It wasn't the intent to do what, unfortunately, I think you're right, it could be read as doing. With that, I'm speaking in shorthand, but I'd like to ask Mr. Bopp his thoughts on that. I assume you would agree that we can't backdoor things in the way we're doing them. But do you have any thoughts on the point Mr. Trister raised on the scope of how this is being written.
I agree with Mike's comments on that. It's really important when that you provide guidance to the to people who are trying to comply with this regulation, and it's very important. And the court in Citizens United was clear in telling you that it's really important that you give clear guidance, that it not be, you don't have to go to court, you don't have to hire a lawyer to comply with this. And I think there's been some comments by a few commissioners about not even being bound by your current definition of coordinated expenditure, as if there's, even though you've adopted regulations explaining exactly what it is, that they, you know, can go over here. And this provision would have the effect of providing some regulatory authority for the proposition that there is still coordination over here that is not defined by your regulations.
Any other questions? Mr. Walther?
Thanks for your comments and thanks for being here. I did. I do share a view. Maybe we ought to take a look at the way we're phrasing our regulations in view of the decision and look at it from the reverse point of view. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a part of the culture here that still exists that needs to be thought about as we go through this process. But having said that, I was wondering if we have a case before the Supreme Court for the that may get cert. The Montana case, and if it does, then there's a potential for some kind of perhaps rethinking of some issues, and I'm wondering if it might be responsible on our part to sit tight and see what the Supreme Court might be doing, especially in view of the comment that Justice Ginsburg made about maybe it's time to rethink some of these issues. I know what your answer is likely to be, but I think it's something that's before us now. It's not like this is the end of the game in terms of possible trimming of Citizens United in some way.
I represent the people in Montana regarding the Montana Supreme Court's decision when they defied the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, and of course, I think what is the most important thing for you in that is that they granted a stay. They only grant stays in the most extraordinary and clear circumstances where you have to demonstrate not only that the court would accept the case, and as you know, they get $5,000 a year and they accept $100,000. So that's a real high bar, but also that they would probably reverse the decision. And if you look at their decisions, they do reverse 3/4 of them, but they don't reverse all of them. They affirm 25%. So this is a very high bar, and even in the concurrence, while Justice Ginsburg and Breyer wanted to express their desire to reconsider Citizens United. Of course, they dissented, not surprising that they would still adhere to that view. But they did say that the lower courts have to comply. This is not optional. Well, I think you're in the same situation. This isn't optional for you to wait for some future case in hopes, in some cases, I'm assuming. I'm not trying to characterize your views, but if one would be hoping for reversal of Citizens United, you're not free as an agency to just wait until that happens. You're obligated to comply, and it is troubling, frankly, that it's now 2 years after Citizens United, and while you adopted a policy not to enforce some of these regulations, how many people out there know that you have policies? You know, many more would know you have regulations. They'd look at them and assume that they're still obligated to comply with those. So it is troubling that you've not addressed the clear implications of Citizens United as to what regulations now need to be repealed and brought into compliance. So I would would counsel you not to wait, you know, and hope, you know, and pray that something changes, but proceed apace with your fulfilling your obligations. If that does happen, of course, in Montana, they can't reverse Citizens United as to you. The constitutionality of, this is my final point, the constitutionality of 441B has already been decided. It is not at issue in the Montana case. You can't look to the Montana case and hope that your statutory provision is going to be resuscitated. It won't be, no matter what the decision is.
I don't want to get into an argument on it, but the fact that the court issued a stay, it seems to me only natural. Otherwise, you would be granting some relief that they don't know whether they're going to give or not. But so that particular issue isn't so much of a concern to me. But when you look at the question as to whether or not the court might say, okay, sort of like they did in Cupertino, Justice Kennedy said, in the extreme case, we're not going to live with the general constitutional law at that point, and said maybe they'll find that there are factors whereby independent expenditures do result in corruption or the appearance thereof in the extreme case, in which case should we take a look and see if there's going to be something like that coming down so we don't jump the gun and then have to revert back. I mean, I'm not asking you to change your mind, but I obviously think until the court grants cert one way or the other, I think the order simply said it's in effect until we grant cert or not, and then at that point the court will order as appropriate.
Well, Montana is arguing is that they're different, that they have a greater history of corporate corruption. There are peculiarities about the state being a small population, etc., all of which they want to argue should create an exception for their statute from the Citizens United holding. Well, that has nothing to do with you. Absolutely nothing. It's perfectly plausible that if that argument prevailed, which I think is extremely unlikely, after all, none of the five that voted in favor of Citizens United joined that concurrence. Even if they would create an exception for Montana, that doesn't create an exception for you. Your question is res judicata. It's decided.
That's all I have at the moment.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tristram, your comments, raised some concerns, excuse me, about any changes to the reporting that takes place with respect to restricted class communications. You raised concerns about having a single report for both restricted class communications and those, and basically IE reports. And also on a somewhat related issue of communications that are both targeted to the restricted class and to the general public. You raised some legal concerns and also some practical difficulties that could arise if we were to change the current reporting regime. And I was just wondering if you might be willing to touch on those and kind of flesh that out a little bit further.
Sure. The NPRM really raised two separate sets of questions about the impact now of the new regime on reporting. And the first point we made is we thought that as a practical matter, continuing to have separate reports for internal communications and separate reports for public communications seemed to us to be continue to be necessary and more practical and efficient, in part because they are subject to different thresholds, and secondly, they are subject to different reporting rules, and thirdly, one of the concerns we had was that right now, if you are doing IEs, you have to certify on your form that they were independent. And of course, that rule does not apply to internal communications. Now, I suppose it's possible to write one form and make it clear that that the certification only applies to public communications and not to internal communications. But it seemed to us to just add a level of confusion or possible confusion that just didn't need to be, and I didn't see anything really to be gained by having new separate reports. People are used to Form 5, Form 9, et cetera, and I didn't see anything to be gained, particularly from going in the direction of one single report. On the other question, what I refer to as mixed communications, it seemed to me that there's really two types. For certain communications which go both to members and to non-members, let's say a mailing, it is absolutely possible for the organization that's doing it to distinguish between the two and to allocate and say, we sent out 1,000 letters and 500 of them went to members and 500 didn't go to members, and they ought not have to treat the ones that went to members as going to the general public for reporting purposes. It's not a big deal, and I didn't see really the issue, and that would be true for many types of communications that organizations undertake, because they are severable. You know who you're sending them to, and it's possible to come up with a really quite accurate allocation between one and the other. The harder question, I think, is what about radio, TV, newspapers, where it just goes out? And we know that the organization has some members out there, and those members may well hear a radio ad or a TV ad. And that seems to me to be theoretically a harder question, but I think, in fact, probably not a very important question, because I think if you do a radio ad or a TV ad or a newspaper ad, a very large percentage is going to go to non-members. And I can't imagine even the largest membership organizations, large unions, the AARP, running an ad and wanting to argue that, well, a very significant number of the people out there in this particular jurisdiction were our members. So I think most organizations in that context will simply report them all as IEs. And I think it's a moot question. What concerns me is the ones where you can separate them, the types of communications, and that's what we wrote about.
Okay. And one thing that stood out to me, just going back to the issue about whether or not to create a single report for both restricted class communications and IEs, was that you said this could have implications beyond just compliance with the FECA, but could also create some problems under the Internal Revenue Code. And I was just wondering if you would comment on that as well.
Sure. Under the Internal Revenue Code, there is a provision called Section 527F, which is a tax. It's part of 527, but it doesn't deal with 527 organizations. It deals with 501C organizations. And what it basically says is that under some circumstances, 501Cs may be taxable on their political activities. But since 1975, when the regulations were issued, the IRS has taken the position that communications to members are not taxable under that provision. So for many, many organizations, they are already keeping track of communications to members for tax reasons, because they don't want to have to pay tax on that. Their position is that when they communicate with their members, it's not taxable under those regulations, IRS regulations. And so it's known to the 501c4 community, to the C5 community, the unions and the trade associations. Everybody's familiar with this line, and I think that because of the tax implications, and I think that So we're not adding some burden that wouldn't already exist because they have their own motivations to keep track communications between members and non-members.
Mr. Bopp, you in your comments and in your introductory statement, you talked about how the distinction between the restricted class and general public remains a relevant one. And I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on this issue about how to report restricted class communications versus IEs, and also, how do you come down on this issue? Do you agree with Mr. Trister?
I'm going to just start saying ditto. So, okay. Yeah, I agree. And I don't really have anything to add. Everybody understands this. And if you start mushing them together, you just multiply, add confusion to the whole process for no apparent gain or benefit.
So would it be safe to say then that I think that the intent behind this this proposal was a simplification intention, but it sounds like, is it safe to say from your perspectives, the intention for simplification would be anything but for those who would be subject to these reporting requirements?
I think it would actually complicate the situation rather than simplify, but I appreciate that motivation, that's for sure, but I think in this case that's what it would do.
Okay. And the final question I have, Mr. Trister, you near the end of your comments talk about that the NPRM raises some confusion about whether or not it would create a reporting requirement for get out the vote and voter registration activities that don't include express advocacy. And just wondering if you might want to, if you could address that concern as
well.
Right.
Well, I put it in because I struggled quite mightily with those. There's two references, two paragraphs, one of which I quoted and the other which I cited, and I couldn't figure out what was going on there, and I was concerned enough about it to say maybe I'm missing something and I can be educated about it. But what seemed to me, the NPRM in two places dealing with get out the vote and voter registration and these sort of special restrictions that exist, restrictions on targeting people for assistance based on who they're going to vote for and so on. And there's two places in the NPRM. And the point is made in the NPRM that under Alternative A, which we support, that those restrictions would no longer exist as a prohibition. That is, say, corporations and unions could do those things. But then it says, but not for reporting purposes. And the first time I read that, I kind of slid over it, and I said, well, I guess that makes sense. And then I started to think about what reporting, what reporting are we talking about here? And as Jim mentioned earlier, the statute right now requires reporting of IEs, it reports of ECs, and of internal communications, and then there's a reporting regime for PACs. There's nothing that says that a corporation or a union that does expenditures, even if you want to make the distinction between expressive and non-expressive, if it's not an IE, if it doesn't meet the definition of IE, then I don't see where there's a reporting obligation at all. And I mean, I don't even see it for a contribution. The truth is, if a nonprofit organization writes a check to a candidate and a candidate accepts it, that may well be illegal. But I don't see anything that says they have to report it, because there's nothing that says you have to report your contributions unless you're a PAC. And so I didn't see it, and since it came up twice, I thought it was worth putting in there and saying, what are you talking about? Where does this come from?
And Mr. Bopp, do you have anything to add on?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you flagging that for us, and I think that was useful. NPRMs are not always pristine documents. Sometimes things don't get articulated as clearly as they should, and sometimes they raise confusion that was certainly not intended. And so certainly flagging these sorts of issues is much appreciated. I don't have anything further.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank all of those who took time to comment on this NPRM, and especially those who took time from their busy schedules to be with us here in person today. I personally greatly appreciate the input from those not necessarily in this building. Not only is it required by the APA process, but I think it's incredibly useful to our thinking on these issues, because I think that we don't certainly have all of the answers here. So we appreciate your comments in helping us think through some of these implications. I would prefer that we are here today addressing a much broader set of issues raised by this case, and as those of you who followed where we are, and as Mr. Bapa said, it's taken us far too long to get to even this small space of doing what we can. So I'm hoping that this won't be the end of our discussion with the public about some of the other issues that are raised by this case. But turning to the issues in this particular NPM, Mr. Trister, I wanted to go back to something that you were discussing earlier with one of my colleagues about a concern that coordination, I think in your words, should be tied to our coordination, coordinated communication regulation. But at the same time, I think I heard you say that you want the commission to reject this idea of non-communicative expenditures by corporations and labor organizations. Are you taking the position that we should be more lax with the types of non-speech, non-communicative expenditures and to permit coordination there? Or did you mean to say that we should be referencing 10920, the regular coordination, instead of the coordinated communication? I just want to get some clarity on that.
The latter point. My concern was that in the proposal for, let me think, I think it's 114.4C1, you've written in, which is the section before you enumerate the different types of public communications, which as I said, we don't really see the need for that. But you now have a coordination sentence or two in that lead-in, and it doesn't refer back to coordinated communications, and we think it should. I was not trying to argue, and I think the NPRM doesn't even suggest, the notion that non-expressive communications that are coordinated would be treated any different than any other kind of in-kind contribution. I'm not arguing that they should be advantaged. I'm just saying that they should be like IEs. If they are independent, then they're not contributions, and they shouldn't be prohibited.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. I did want to return to the issue that Commissioner Peterson was discussing about allocation for mixed communications, and I appreciate your breakdown, Mr. Trister, of there's this sort of easier class where people really do keep track of these sorts of things and the other class. And I'm hoping you might help us with what a regulatory solution might be here. And given your comment about enumerated lists, I might guess at your answer, but I did want your thinking on this, because some commenters suggested that this idea of regulation or of allocation is a regulatory burden that should be avoided. But you're suggesting to us that actually that allocation is something that's useful and is readily accessible by organizations. So if we were to capture that in our regulations, would we try to enumerate the types of things like radio and TV ads that might be difficult to allocate, or would you suggest a regulation that would tell an organization that they should be allocating where it's possible, where it's accessible? You see our problem in trying to figure out how to give guidance in this area.
Right, I'm not sure whether there isn't guidance out there already, not regulatory guidance, but just through RAD and sort of informal practice on that. But I don't think I would be troubled if the list is correct in making a distinction in the regulations that says that you can report certain kinds of mixed communications separately if you wish, and other kinds where an allocation isn't really feasible, that that you have to report them as IEs, because as I said, I think at least in the groups I talked to during this process, they basically said, "Well, we're not trying to argue that when we do a radio ad that, you know, 85% of it was to the general public and 15% was to our members." And I'm not aware of that. Perhaps other witnesses are aware of that kind of approach, but. So I wouldn't have any problem with some distinction like that in the regulation.
Okay, thank you. I'll just note that RAD guidance is always a great thing. So glad to hear that you appreciate their guidance. I don't have any further questions.
Any other questions? Comments? Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Bopp and Mr. Trister, for joining us this morning. We'll take a recess and reconvene at 11:30 with the second panel. Thank you very much.